So this week it's me and Steph, and we have a fun topic to talk about too, mm-hmm. but we were also getting caught up on what we're both reading and watching lately. Yeah. So that's probably what our icebreaker will be here now.
I love knowing what people are reading and watching.
I do too. Yeah. Reading wise. So I actually Play Nice, which is what we were just talking about a little bit off air, by Rachel Harrison, is actually, that's the last like reading. For the sake of like everyone involved, we know that when I say listening versus reading, we're not saying that listening isn't reading. So the last book that I like read with my eyeballs was Play Nice. I just loved it.
Oh, yay.
You and Justine have like effectively, and I think Hallie, have just made me a Rachel Harrison fan.
I don't know. I think I wonder about horror a lot, if I'll mm-hmm. like it. And she is like a really approachable.
Yes.
Like writes it in a really approachable way where it kind of just feels like a thriller.
Mm-hmm.
If you're into thrillers, that it's digestible and it doesn't like go over your head a lot, but it's, and her characters are just our style.
Yeah, her female main characters are just fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
You'll feel all of the millennial girl vibes, or love is what I meant to say, but I said vibes. I guess both work. But yeah, it's a fun one. So it's about a woman who she basically inherits this house that her mom lived in, that she lived into for a period of her childhood. But her mom became convinced that it was possessed, and she kind of moves back in to renovate it and see what she can do with it. Some crazy stuff starts happening. It's literally on the cover. It says a haunted house novel. So like, no spoilers. This is like what you're going in for, but she's so snarky. I love the main character. It's amazing. And Cleo's such a cool name.
Yeah, I agree. Like how many things we have highlighted too in mm-hmm. it. Like she just says things, observes the world in such a, like, I guess snarky, but just a way that like you don't always see it written. Mm-hmm. And I love it.
I do too. Yeah, that one's really good. I was trying to think of one of the audiobooks I'm listening to right now, because now sometimes I have a nonfiction audiobook and a fiction. Kind of depends on like when my Libby holds come in, and that's what's happening right now. But I'm reading one called Eloquent Rage by Brittany Cooper. And so my friend Mackenzie, who's been on the podcast a few times, she just started a Substack, and I'll put the link in these show notes too, because I think a lot of you probably are interested in similar stuff. But her Substack is all about words. So she's like super into language and like how it matters. She kind of starts the Substack off talking about a word slut that we've kind of talked about a couple times here, mm-hmm. and just any of Amanda Montell's books. And that really got her even more into words. So she just loves like sociolinguistics. She loves words. She loves stories. She loves books. So you might want to follow her, but this was she kind of put like a syllabus together for herself that was like books to read over the next, I don't know, year. I don't know what her time frame was, that would help her nerd out even more on words. And so this one is called, it's called Eloquent Rage, A Black Feminist Discovers Her Superpower. Oh my goodness. This author reads it. She reads it and oh my, like you can feel how much she means every fucking word that she's saying. And at the very beginning, the first chapter is all about sass and like the different, how it has positive and negative connotations, mm-hmm. and has a line at one point where she's like, and not only am I a black woman, I'm a fat black woman. So my sass is like never appreciated. Or like she's talking about how it gets perceived even more negatively. But the way that she said it was just like, it's heavy material, but she was making me laugh so much. And the whole first chapter too is all about how she has been angry about things her whole life and not been afraid to just be the person who will talk about those topics. Yeah. So I love you, Brittany Cooper, is what I'm saying, basically.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
So hold on, I'm scratching.
Oh, yeah.
Get in here. Come on. Come on. In or out? In or out? Lily. She like scratches at the door and then she sits there and I'm like, oh, you just wanted to know what was going on.
So Harley's like that.
I need to get a cat door, seriously. Anyway, that sounds really good. Mm-hmm. So you're not done with that one?
Yeah, that one I'm currently listening to right now and I'm really enjoying it. Mm-hmm. And yeah, she's just diving into all kinds of subjects. Oh, was it in that one? No, that was another one I read recently. But I was reading one recently. So, like, in general, trying to broaden my perspective on feminism because, like, very mainstream feminism is one thing.
Right.
And it's not always, you know, actually about equality for all women. And so I've been wanting to read some more of that. And I was even just, oh, it was Hood Feminism was what I listened to, like, earlier this month. Mm-hmm. Where she talked about, like, a big part of the feminist movement when it started, like, we're talking, like, 60s, 70s, was mostly a lot of white women employing not white women to take care of their house. And so they could go be feminist or go get a job. So, it, like, even the origins of it in our country started off where it was like, oh, these non-white women can handle all the tasks I don't want to handle so that I can go be an empowered woman. So it's always been a little bit imbalanced. And I'm like, that does sadly make sense for our country. So I'm just trying to learn about it.
Well, it makes sense. It's not like anyone ever could really do it all.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's not that they were doing every piece. They're like, okay, well, I want to go get a job because I wasn't allowed to, but like, that doesn't mean that I'm doing everything.
Yeah.
And I think there's like the painting and then there's like what's actually happening.
Yeah, definitely.
That's really interesting. What are you listening to for your fiction right now?
So I just finished it and it's one that I'm going to talk about today. It's called The Great Man by Kira. I don't know if it's Kira or Kira Davis Lurie. And this is another one. I'm just going to keep talking about Mackenzie. We were talking over the weekend or like right before the weekend about, I can't even remember, audiobooks. And there was one that I got really interested in. That's like it's a Great Gatsby retelling. But it's from a queer Asian American perspective. So I was like telling her that had popped on my radar. And then she told me The Great Man by Kira Davis Lurie she was like, that's also a Gatsby retelling.
Oh.
And I was intrigued. So I went to Libby and I placed a hold, as one does. And it said there were four people in front of me. And the next morning I woke up and it was like, your hold is available.
Yeah. So
I actually got it really quickly and I have 30 minutes left on it right now. But I loved it. It's a really good Gatsby retelling. And then obviously I'll read the synopsis later, but yeah, it's a retelling basically that takes place in 1945 and it's a black man instead in the black community.
I'm curious about that. Like, I remember reading The Great Gatsby, and then when the movie came out, I watched it, but I kind of forget, like, some of the main themes of it, so I'm interested to hear about that. I just also finished my fiction audiobook this morning.
Oh, yeah.
It is called... I heard of it from Brit Lit, who is on Bookstagram, and she... I'm always, like, into her reviews because I feel like she's not an easy reviewer, but she also really liked Margot's Got Money Troubles and Allison Esbach's books, which are Notes on Your Disappearance and The Wedding People. So she posted this book called Francine's Spectacular Crash and Burn.
Oh, okay.
And It's kind of a similar, like, big topics, but like told in a way where you can find like some humor in them.
Yeah.
And I've also been like hoping somewhere behind the scenes to find some stories like that that are not always about white women. And so like this one is not. And so it was just really interesting. And I don't know if I learned anything to talk about it today, but I might talk about it later just because it is like a, I hadn't read anything like it before, but it was, and Bonnie Turpin obviously is amazing. So she created it.
Ah, I love her.
I know. Her voice is so unique. I remember the first time I heard her was in Grady Hendrix's vampire book.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, who is this?
Yeah.
Like, this is fantastic.
Yes.
Because I was, and then I remember like rating it and I'm like, the story was fine, but like the narration was incredible.
I know. That's what has me almost listening to a book about a pirate. We'll see if it happens. Yeah. Yeah, she's amazing. I really love her and Angel Peen are two of my favorites right now.
Oh, so good. Also, speaking of audiobooks and nonfiction, a book that has been on my radar for a while, but like I don't know if I could like handle it, unfortunately, right now, is The Barn. I think it's about Emmett Till, because didn't the anniversary of his death just come up? That one is on my Libby, just like straight available, but I believe the some people's feedback on the audio is that the timelines shift so much that sometimes it can be challenging on audio. But I'm still very intrigued. If anyone has listened to or read that, I'd be interested to hear what people's feedback
Me too.
Was. Oh, and then just a real quick drive-by. We finished a documentary on the Dallas Cowboys this weekend.
Nice.
Yeah. I do like sports documentaries more than sports usually.
Same.
We finished the catfishing in the high school one.
Yeah.
Crazy. And then Gone Girls about the a Long Island serial killer that was if anyone, it reminded me so much of Please See Us by Caitlin Mullen.
Yes. Yeah, I remember you.
So we watched a lot this weekend. We don't usually watch that much TV.
That's awesome. Every now and then it's nice to have that.
Yeah.
I need to, we'll see. We'll see. I've been narrating and editing an audiobook in the time that is normally like watching TV or reading time, but. Thank God for audiobooks because I can still listen while I'm working.
Yeah, TV has definitely become like a buy, like a, yeah. It happens or it doesn't, like whatever.
Right. That's what I've been running into too.
Yeah.
Well, I guess I can talk about my first one since I kind of teased it a little bit.
Yeah, stuff we learned from fiction. Speaking of
yes, fiction. I loved this idea because – one, we love to talk about empathy in general and how much you can develop your empathy muscle with reading. And then there's also the kind of cool part that reading stories that have like some historical significance or just really any significance technically sometimes helps you like learn more about reality as well, even if it's what am I trying to say? It just left my head completely. I don't know. but something about it being told in like a fictional story sometimes makes it more accessible. Oh, that's what I was going to say. Even if you learn it directly from the book, or if it, I was thinking about it when I was looking at mine, if it makes you like Google stuff that you hadn't, or research stuff you hadn't thought about before. So
yeah.
We just love that part of fiction. So wanted to talk about fiction books that taught us stuff. So, as I was saying, with this The Great Man by Kira Davis Lurie, first off, this probably, like, her author's note that was at the beginning, which, like, by the way, more author's notes, let's put them at the beginning, because sometimes it just needs to be at the beginning. And, like, you have so much more context, especially with this one. So this author, her author's note, she basically talks about how much she loved The Great Gatsby and F. Scott Fitzgerald in general, like when she was in high school, like she loved reading it. And then she stayed a big fan of his work. But she also talks about how, like, there are some, the way she frames it is, while nothing he says ever seems to rise to the level of hate, he definitely had some racist stuff within his writing, is where she's headed with that, essentially. And in The Great Gatsby, I haven't read it in years, so I didn't really remember much at all. But in The Great Gatsby, there are three, I never know what to call it. I think she says that he calls them colored people. I know that is not the correct terminology overall, but that's how they're referenced in The Great Gatsby. And, like, they're also wealthy. And to her, it, like, stuck out to her that to this man, part of, like, making this fantastical world was like, oh, it would be fantastical for Black people to also be wealthy. And so it was kind of part of the fantasy of the story. And so those three characters that only are on, like, one page stuck with her forever. And she was like, I want to know about, like, what those characters would have gone through, like, if they were actually getting to live this American dream. So one of the big overarching themes of The Great Gatsby is talking about class warfare. It's within white people. But just class warfare, as well as, like, the American dream and what you're willing to do for it. Mm-hmm. So it's been so good listening to this book, because she's taking so many different approaches to the American dream by acting like we're in a world in 1945 where there's, like, this super wealthy community of Black people in LA. So that is me going on and on about just the author's note. But here's the synopsis. Settling in a local actress's energetic boarding house, Charlie discovers a different way of life, one brimming with opportunity from a promising career at a Black-owned... Okay, this didn't start at the beginning. I was scrolled too far down. Okay. I will restart and mark. I was like, I feel like we're missing stuff. So in 1945, Charlie Trammell steps off a cross-country train into the vibrant tapestry of Los Angeles. Lured by his cousin Marguerite's invitation to the esteemed West Adams Heights, Charlie is immediately captivated by the Black opulence of LA's newly rechristened Sugar Hill. Settling in at a local actress's energetic boarding house, Charlie discovers a different way of life, one brimming with opportunity from a promising career at a Black-owned insurance firm, the absence of Jim Crow, to the potential of an unforgettable romance. But nothing dazzles quite like James Reaper Mann. Reaper's extravagant parties, attended by luminaries like Lena Horne and Hattie McDaniel, draw Charlie in, bringing the milieu of wealth and excess within his reach. But as Charlie's unusual bond with Reaper deepens, so does the tension in the neighborhood, as white neighbors, frustrated by their dwindling fortunes, ignite a landmark court case that threatens the community's well-being with promises of retribution. Told from the unique perspective of a young man who has just returned from a grueling segregated war, The Great Man weaves a compelling narrative of wealth and class, illuminating the complexities of Black identity and education in post-war America.
Wow, sir.
Yeah. So she really does a lot of things while using this story that is, like, super popular, especially in Americana. Most notably, like, can you imagine? This is what was really sticking out to me. Can you imagine being drafted and having to go fight in a war at a time when the government also still says you're only 3/5 of a person? You're not even a full person. However, we can send you to war. Mm-hmm. And then he goes through all of the horrificness that is war. And then he comes back to his home in the South, and it's back to, like, Jim Crow laws, and, like, you don't get to go in front of them in line. Like, you always have to keep going to the back of the line. And I'm just like, you want to talk about rage.
Yeah.
Like, can you imagine that? And we don't really talk about the fact that Black men also fought in World War II, even when they were considered second rate citizens in their own country. And I'm like, that's it's just fucked.
Yeah. And the way that, like, only at so in so much of our history, the only people that were allowed to be mad were white men.
Yeah.
Like, it. you can't yell, you can't, or like, you're gonna get in trouble, you can't. Yeah. Like, what can you do without, like, huge, I don't know, like, yes, obviously eventually,
yeah,
people were mad, but like, I don't know, that's just crazy.
Well, and they're the ones who have the least to be angry about. That's the other crazy part.
I know, because I was thinking, like, women, if you yell, you get sent to a mental institution.
Yep.
And or you could just get killed. It's
yeah,
so nasty.
Just burned at the stake.
Ugh. Yeah, that sounds really interesting.
Yeah, it's really good.
How long was it?
The narration is really good. It's 9 hours.
Oh, that's not bad.
Yeah. Yeah, so like 3 days to read it or to listen, really.
Nice.
Yeah. To open my fucking
door. Figure it out. Okay. So the book that got, that made me want to text Kate about this topic.
Oh, yeah.
It's called You Know Her by Megan Jennett. And I had seen this reel on Instagram about the color Haint Blue. And oh, yeah. I was like, wow, I remember that because I was reading this book where this detective paints her house, her porch roof, Haint Blue. And she like happens to see Haints. And I had never even heard
oh, wow.
spirits or ghosts referred to that as that before.
Same.
So
well, I like, didn't until wow, I learned
yeah I was like I learned about that through fiction, so I was like, isn't that so interesting?
Yeah.
So You Know Her is it's one of my most tabbed books I have, but
really
it's like a female, I don't know if you can see,
oh wow, yeah, that's I love that.
It's like a female who is a serial killer, and just like once again her observations are like pretty spot on about things, but the detective who they kind of play like a, are they friends, does the detective know what she's doing in her free time, she's her family, I think they're from the South where that's what she painted her porch ceiling. Mm. 2 hours before he vanished, Mark Dixon stole a glass of wine. That's what bartender Sophie Brom tells the cops after they question her about the customer whose mutilated body has just been found. What she doesn't tell them is that she's the one who killed him. Officer Nora Martin is new to the Bel-Air Police Department and is trying very hard to learn the ropes from Detective Murphy while ignoring all her male colleagues griping about a diversity hire. Relevant.
Yep.
When she meets Sophie, they build an uneasy camaraderie shared over frustrations. As winter slides into spring and bodies start piling up, Nora begins to suspect that something's not quite right with the unnerving, enigmatic bartender. But will she be able to convince Murph, or will he keep laughing off the idea that the serial killer haunting their little town is a woman? So it has a lot to do with that, but also like I could take a whole nother book on just the detective.
Oh, wow.
She like kind of sees spirits and I'm like, I love that.
I do love that.
So like when you said that your book there was like a lot happening, this book I felt like there was a lot happening as well, and I could use like more in like different books. So I don't know if she's working on anything else, but
yeah. Because this one's 2023. I wonder if she is. Yeah, it also says Killing Eve meets Sharp Objects. And I'm like,
yeah.
You know, I need that. Mm-hmm. Everyone who's listening is like, why is she quiet? My jaw drops.
Yeah. Did you ever read Real Easy by Maria Wachowski? Okay. So that one I
it's a strip club, right?
Just, yes.
Okay.
I tabbed that one almost as much. Like for one of the quotes was like, or perhaps to give him a hug to placate him for the only way she knew how early girls learn to soothe the anger of men. God.
Wow.
Yeah, that's so good. Quotes like that.
Yeah. I need to read that one. Another, I don't know why my brain is glitching so much on me, but, I just got Boomtown on NetGalley 2, which also kind of takes place in a strip club. And those, it was just making me think of how I wanted to read real easy, but I have not yet. I need to look at the audio probably.
That one has a lot of perspectives. That would be really interesting.
Yeah. Oh yeah, you're right. Because it is known for how many perspectives it has. Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah. Well, now I want to read both of those. You know, her is available on Libby for me. And I'm like,
I bet.
Kate, you're overflowing with audio.
The audio right or the
audio.
Book or both. Oh, does it say who the narrator is? Are there two or just one?
Let's look.
I have no idea where my phone is to even look at anything.
I closed it, so I was like, Kate, you have to think about it before you do this. Oh yeah, it is too. Sophie Amos and Z Sands. XE.
Ooh, she's good.
Okay.
XE Sands, I think that's how you say
X-E?
It.
XE. Okay.
I don't know for sure, but that's what I hear everybody say.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I did not know. So yeah. Now I'm interested in that one. Oh boy, so many. I also, I know.
It's like, just keep adding.
I know. I also, now I want to listen to, I'm watching Margaret Atwood's masterclass. It's really good. She is like very darkly funny, as you would probably expect.
Right.
But she's talking about her book, The Blind Assassin. And there are four levels of book within a book in it. Yeah. So it's like apparently the most metafiction out there, but she had so much fun putting it together. And so the way she was talking about how intricate the storytelling structure is had me like, oh my God, I'm going to love it. Like I love having to follow a lot of those details. But then I saw in Storygraph, it said, if you're prepared for glacial pacing, and it scared me. Because I can do medium pace now way more than I used to.
Yeah.
Actually, I think I tend to do medium more lately. But glacial, I was like, oh no. And it's 600 pages. It's an 18-hour audiobook. So I just can't decide, but I'm so intrigued. And I had a couple people respond and say like, no, you'll still like it.
Oh.
I'm like, glacial is such a big word to use.
Right. Or like the reviews say that, or that, because that was on the front, like the main page of the Storygraph account.
Yeah, there are a lot of people who are like, why is it this long?
Oh.
Like any book that's length. But I listened to Katabasis last week and that one was 18 hours. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. We'll see. We'll see what I end up doing.
I wonder if it's just like, if it's four books within a book, I imagine you have to spend a decent amount of time
probably
like preparing for the next. So I wonder if that's why.
Yeah.
There's just like so much.
Yeah. Because apparently it's like, there's like, I think there's maybe like a biography level, and then there's a level of like what the newspapers were saying. So then you have all these perspectives to try to figure out what actually happened in this family. So it sounds interesting to me.
Yeah.
So I don't know. But that was why I was like, you don't have to get, you know, her right now, Kate, because I'm so torn.
I just put I made a list called interested.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Everything lives.
Yeah, I need to do that too.
Ooh, also, by the way, Julia Haberlin gave The Great Man 5 stars.
So, ooh.
Love that.
Yeah. Yeah, it is very good. She is talking about a lot of stuff in one story. It's pretty impressive.
Love it.
But I had to talk about this one. I know we've talked about it before, but this is technically the one that got, I would say, is the one that most recently opened me to historical fiction, if we don't count like 7 Husbands of Evelyn Hugo. Like, yes, it's historical, but so The Lion Women of Tehran by Marjan Kamali, last year, before I knew I was gonna be an audiobook girly, this was probably the one that helped me realize, like, I love badass women in almost any time period.
Yeah.
Wow. So in 1950s Tehran, 7-year-old Ellie lives in grand comfort until the untimely death of her father, forcing Ellie and her mother to move to a tiny home downtown. Lonely and bearing the brunt of her mother's endless grievances, Ellie dreams for a friend to alleviate her isolation. Luckily, on the first day of school, she meets Homa, a kind girl with a brave and irrepressible spirit. Together, the two girls play games, learn to cook in the stone kitchen of Homa's warm home. wander through the colorful stalls of the Grand Bazaar and share their ambitions of becoming lion women. But their happiness is disrupted when Ellie and her mother are afforded the opportunity to return to their previous bourgeois life. Now a popular student at the best girls' high school in Iran, Ellie's memories of Homa begin to fade. Years later, however, her sudden reappearance in Ellie's privileged world alters the course of both of their lives. Together, the young women come of age and pursue their own goals for meaningful futures. But as the political turmoil in Iran builds to a breaking point, one earth-shattering betrayal will have enormous consequences. There's just so much about this book. The friendship is amazing, and just something I really love is both girls approach life like super differently. And like for me, I realized how much I recognize myself in both of them. Like sometimes you are like a big, loud, like I'm going to stand up against this type person. And sometimes you do act out of self-preservation. And I resonate with both technically. And so I thought it was a very empathetic and like fair analysis or whatever, like story of how both women can be very different, and then but their friendship is still so meaningful. So there's that part. Historically, I was not aware how liberal Iran was, or progressive. I mean, liberal is what we're saying. Like the women were not like forced to wear religious garb if that was not their religion and they didn't want to. They had careers. Like I did not know that like that was how Iran was until this fundamental religious takeover. And I read it like I think like 3 months before the election last year. Yeah, August of last year. Wow. So it was like literally a year ago. And I remember being like, we need to care about this story because things can change this quickly. And a year later it just feels more relevant. So yeah. There's that. But it's just, it's a very powerful story.
Yeah. I admire Homa so much because I like wish I was like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it is nice to know that there's like quieter ways to make a difference too.
That too.
Yeah.
Yeah. I will say that's something fascinating that this book does. And actually The Great Man does a really good job of that, where it's like, do you betray your gender? Do you betray your race when you do stuff that you just kind of have to survive, but maybe like hurts the race overall? Like how do you even begin to make those decisions as a person? Both of those books really flesh that out and how difficult that choice is.
Right. Because if you could just like say screw it all and just go balls to the wall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We could, but especially the older we get, you know, there's like more consequences.
Yeah.
But then sometimes that sounds so stupid, but like it's true.
Right.
It's true.
It is.
Yeah, that one's so good. And the audio is incredible.
I know. I wish I was into audiobooks then, but I think I need to listen to The Stationery Shop.
Yeah, I think
so. You said the audio is good for that too.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, speaking of religion, I am not a religious person, but I find religion very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And I just finished, if anyone listened to the last episode about Knife River that Gary and we were talking about, one of the characters talked about how their mom was like a Quaker or like visited, I don't know if they called a church, I forgot.
Mm-hmm.
But I was like, oh, I read this other book where the main character is a Quaker, and I found it so fascinating, like how he dealt with grief, like in that world. And this one is called What Comes After by Joanne Tompkins.
Okay.
This one is, I would say it was, it's kind of slower, but I gave it 5 stars. I was like dying, crying at one
point. Yeah.
After the shocking deaths of two teenage boys tear apart a community in the Pacific Northwest, an unfamiliar pregnant girl emerges out of the woods and into the lives of those same boys' families. Why the boys died and what their tragedy has to do with this girl are the propulsive mysteries at the center of Joanne Tompkins' story. But just as urgent is the question of how the families will move forward. What comes after grief? What does forgiveness look like? In misty coastal Washington, Isaac's teenage son Daniel is gone, leaving Isaac alone in a rambling Victorian home, shocked and grieving. The friendships and faith that once nourished him are flickering. Next door, Lori, a single working mother, struggles with the final act committed by her own teenage son. The two parents are separated by only a silvery stretch of trees, but emotionally they are stranded, isolated by their great losses, until they meet Evangeline. Fiery in hair and spirit, 16, pregnant and alone, Evangeline's unexplained arrival changes everything. At first, it feels like a blessing and a bridge across a divide, but the girl clearly is hiding something about her connection to the boys and their deaths. Soon, all three characters are forced to examine what really happened in their overlapping pasts and what it all possibly means for a shared future.
Wow.
Yeah, I think, like, when we were talking with Gare about just, like, bleak kind of books yes. And, like, processing what happens after a really tragic event. Mm-hmm. There's something about books about grief that it's like, they're not fast paced, but no. they can be like so incredibly hooking. Like they, mm-hmm. it, like you can hook you. And that's,
it's like the stakes are still so high. I think that's some of it is like emotionally, it's such a huge thing to work through.
Correct. And there's so many ways you can go about it. And the decisions mm-hmm. are typically not always great.
No.
But like you can understand why they're made.
Mm-hmm.
So the Isaac, he is a Quaker, and so he talks about how he like will just sit in silence mm-hmm. for a long time, or like he sits with other people from his church and they'll like ask questions, but you're not like if the second it gets not neutral, I guess mm-hmm. you could say, like it's over. Like it's just like such an interesting process. Like
yeah.
what it is so foreign to me.
Mm-hmm.
There are pieces of it that sound like really nice.
Yeah.
And then there's other pieces of it where I'm like, I don't know. So it was fascinating to me.
I know I felt that way too, because I know a lot of their church or whatever, same as you. I'm like, I can't remember if it's called church.
Is
sitting in silence together.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like there is the whole part of like being able to be alone with yourself, or I mean you're in a group in that case, but like for a lot of I'm not saying that it's like always easy for me, but it's not totally difficult for me to sit in silence. Actually, I kind of love it. Mm-hmm. But when you're having that heavier stuff, it's like more intimidating to do that, but you're like a lot healthier if you can kind of like connect with the part of yourself that's like, you are okay right now.
Yeah, right.
So that stuff always, I think it's the same stuff, some of the same stuff in Quakerism or whatever it is probably the same stuff that intrigues me with like Buddhism as well.
Yeah, I could see that, because I think one of the things that was really hard is like the anger that like mm-hmm. pushes through like to try and overcome that and to sit in that, like you're so mad.
Yeah.
And it just was like,
yeah,
it was hard for him.
A lot of big feelings.
Who wouldn't be? Your kid died.
I know. Yeah. I don't.
Yeah.
I don't know how parents move on from that. I was like trying to think of the way to word it. And I'm like, that's literally it. That it has to be one of the worst things to live through, I would assume. Is like outliving your children.
Yeah, there's some really interesting things online, like not to be super morbid, but somehow this account came up of like I think if you ever read books like The Collected Regrets of Clover, where she's like a death doula.
Oh, okay.
Like now that I've read about that, it's such, I guess I could have talked about that today.
Like no, you
such
are
a fascinating topic and how important those people are. And like somehow it came up on my feed and it was just like such a fascinating thing to like make it like not scary and like how you move through it. And I was like, I don't know how much this is going to come up now, because I kind of like went into it a little bit.
Yeah.
But like I don't know. It was just fascinating.
It is fascinating because there are people like, I think almost all cultures, maybe other than ours, talk about death more. And it's like not as like nerve wracking and like, oh, we don't talk about that. Like, and they have more rituals around it, I think, too. But like, yeah, the people who are death doulas are fascinating.
Yeah, there was this clip that I've seen multiple times now about this Australian mom on a podcast with three guys.
Mm.
She talks about losing her daughter and like the way she talks, because it's been like 10 years. So she's able to talk about it without like breaking down at this point, because she's like, I've gone through it. And I think that's the only thing you can do.
That's true.
And so, and it was, I'll never remember the clip, but like I've seen it now like three times, and it was such a interesting thing to listen to this woman talk about.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is. Well, my next one has some loss in it. I definitely thought of this one because I just read Vanessa Lilly's second in this series. So Blood Sisters is the first one.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, I could have talked about The Bone Thief, but it doesn't come out until October. So I just kind of like, but I will say The Bone Thief covers even more kind of historical stuff. There's some more specific historical stuff that it, like I learned about reading that one, but the first one does as well. So here we go. There are secrets in the land. As an archaeologist for the Bureau of Indian Affairs, Sid Walker spends her days in Rhode Island trying to protect the land's indigenous past, even as she's escaping her own. While Sid is dedicated to her job, she's haunted by a night of violence she barely escaped in her Oklahoma town 15 years ago. Though she swore she'd never go back, the past comes calling. When a skull is found near the crime scene of her youth, just as her sister, Emma Lou, vanishes, Sid knows she must return home. She refuses to let her sister's disappearance or the remains go ignored, as so often happens in cases of missing Native women. But not everyone is glad to have Sid home, and she can feel the crosshairs on her. Still, the deeper Sid digs, the more she uncovers about a string of missing Indigenous women cases going back decades. To save her sister, she must expose a darkness in the town that no one wants to face, not even Sid. This one's just so good, and it's like action-packed. Yeah. Like,
and the storm at the end too. It's like, yes, from all angles.
Yeah. I just love it. She's very good at these like actiony thrillers. So I definitely, by the time I read this one, like knew about like missing and murdered Indigenous women and like how many have gone missing or been murdered or assumed murdered for decades. But there were parts of this that still had me like kind of researching some of it. And she also kind of wove in some of the details of like the disrespect to the land that was happening in Oklahoma at this time too. When we had our conversation about what is historical fiction, she commented and said how some people consider this historical fiction because it takes place in 2008. Which like might be stretching it a little bit. Like I didn't think of it as historical fiction, but no. She does touch on some things that were happening in Oklahoma as well, where you're just like, wow. People have
that
just
is yesterday historical fiction. Jesus.
Yeah, for real. Yeah, people like especially Indigenous people have just not been treated well, and it continues on. So there's a lot of that gets covered in this one, but there's even more of it in the next one that is just like, whoa.
I think that Indigenous literature is so interesting in the sense that there's like the actual historical fiction part, and then I also find it fascinating when they are like storytelling, like the lore and like the spiritual pieces of it are so interesting to me. And like, I don't know, I think there's so much opportunity by reading more.
Yeah.
Like I loved one of the books I read by Nick Medina. His first book was like so interesting because it had like a horror piece to it. So like, yes, it talked about like some of the injustices within like reality, but then like the storytelling too was mm-hmm. like so good.
That's crazy, because right before you were saying that, I was gonna say that like the book I'm physically reading is The Whistler by Nick Medina right now. Okay. And it is like, this is my first one. I haven't read his other ones, but I want to now. It is like, the prologue is terrifying and super creepy and builds like all of this huge horror momentum. And then like, then you get into like the regular chapters, still so terrifying and creepy, but like also like they're like on the reservation or not on the reservation. So there's like also that kind of folklore that you're kind of talking about getting woven into it. And it's like, it just works so well. So I'm liking yeah. his new one that way too.
Yeah. One of the only times I was like, I did not anticipate being creeped out at yeah. all. And I was like laying there in bed at night thinking about this, like, head rolling around
town. Yeah.
And I was like, why am I creeped out by this? And I was like,
sometimes wow, it's really so visceral, it like sticks in your head.
Yeah. And it's probably has like meaning, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. There's like so much reason behind it all, and
right
like metaphors and stuff. I don't know, it's like, okay,
yeah, totally,
I love that.
Yeah, some good ones. I love Vanessa too.
And then she's part of the quad group that has yes. a new book coming out as well.
Which one? Wicked?
Wicked.
Something Deadly, no. Widows?
I thought it was two W's.
I thought so too.
Well, I guess Wicked and Widows.
Hey, let's see what it says here. Wicked Wanted Widows.
I thought it was three. Mm-hmm.
Yep. With Kimberly Bell.
Ooh.
And Kate Hollihan and Lane Fargo.
Nice. Nice. Oh, I'm not sure about how to move on to the next thing.
That's okay.
How many do we have left? Two?
Uh-huh. I have two.
Okay. Well, I think that one that I thought was really interesting and has a really gorgeous cover was Do What Godmother Says.
Yes.
By L.S. Stratton, Shelley Stratton. This is one of the most beautiful covers I think.
It's amazing.
I like a little fleur-de-lis black and like
yes.
gold, a vintage gold frame. You're gonna get me every time.
And the like paint drips from the text.
Yeah. So this is dual timelines and it takes place. Well, it'll say, but it's probably one of my favorite, like, going back in time.
Yeah.
Shanice Pierce knows better than to heed bad omens, but she has a hard time ignoring the signs when she finds herself newly single and out of a job on the same seemingly cursed day. Then, while cleaning out her grandmother's house, Shanice comes across a painting she hasn't seen in years. Drawn to the haunting portrait in a way she can't explain, Shanice accepts her grandmother's offer to keep the family heirloom. She soon uncovers the story of the artist, a Harlem Renaissance painter named Estelle Johnson. The young woman was taken under wing by the wealthy art patron Maud Bachman, or Godmother, as she insisted her artists called her, and vanished shortly after the Bachman's brutal murder a century ago. As Shanice digs deeper, she becomes convinced she's being stalked and that the deaths happening around her are connected to the staggering offer she turned down for the painting. But the truth hiding in plain sight is even more shocking and deadly than Shanice could have possibly imagined. So there's like this psychological aspect of it, of like, am I going crazy?
Yes.
Like, so much stuff is happening to me. But then mm-hmm. also, so like there's a major thriller part.
Yes.
And then you're wondering like what's happening to her relative in the past, who, like you talked about earlier, like she thinks she got this like amazing opportunity, but like, is anything in that era as good as it seems? Or is it too good to be true?
Black women, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Especially if you have some talent and someone yeah. else could make money off of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I had never really heard about, like, how many times are we going to talk about this today? Granted, it's not always about, like, I didn't know much about Quakerism either, besides maybe when we talked about, like, the pilgrims. I don't know. Like, but I am like, how many times can we say, like, I didn't know much about this? And that's so stupid and so depressing. Yeah. But I didn't know about the Harlem Renaissance or, like, anything like this happening. But it tracks with
life
at that time, I'm sure.
Yeah, I didn't know about the Harlem Renaissance until the last 2 years, maybe. Maybe 2 years, I don't know. there's just so much where I'm like, we could have included more in history class. Like, because there's so many, like, not even, I think some people get hung up on thinking that means only bad things. And it's like, no, not even that. We're just, like, not including some of the great things that happened in history, too. Mm-hmm. It's crazy. I got with Audible. They had the, like, buy one, get one. I love, they kind of do it every other month. And, like,
oh,
I understand they're Amazon, but can't pass up the deal at the moment. And I got
a supporting author.
Right. Exactly. That's what sometimes I'm like, guys, like, the author still wants us to consume their content if they can, or if we can. But I got Harlem Rhapsody by Victoria Christopher Murray. And I'm excited to listen to that one, but it takes place during the Harlem Renaissance as well. And is about W.E.B. Du Bois. I think the S is pronounced for some reason. I didn't realize that until recently. But my friend Mackenzie responded. She was like, this book is so messy. And I was like, really? So apparently it's
wait, a who messy said that?
Little book. Mackenzie? My friend Mackenzie. Yeah, she responded and said it's really messy. So I'm kind of excited. Like, it has, like, Langston Hughes, Nella Larson. Like, it incorporates people. Mm-hmm. So I'm excited about that one. But yeah, it's like something else I just never heard about, and now I'm like finding it in all kinds of books, and it's like fun to read about.
Yeah
I will say Do What Godmother Says has some Sinners vibes, so if you liked the idea of, like, wanting to kind of vampirically feed off of someone else's talent, especially in relation to race, like, you'd probably love this book too.
Yeah, that whole art of all types
concept. Yeah.
It's interesting you say that. I was going to just do it as, like, a drive-by today, mm-hmm. but when you talk about, like, the famous people that are mentioned in Harlem Rhapsody, I think there is, like, a famous artist that is talked about in Do What Godmother Says. I can't remember the name, but I recognize the name. And then also, if you read The Reformatory by Tiana Reeve Dew, there are pieces that talk about, like, lawyers from the time, or, like, there's real people, like, inserted in fictional ways, which is kind of cool.
That was the other one. And that was my BOGO. That was the other one I got with Audible was The Reformatory. And so
incredible narrator.
Oh, really? Nice. That's good to know.
She reminds me of, I think, the one that you like, Angel.
Oh, okay.
That's what I'm thinking of.
Yeah.
There's kind of, like, this wispiness to their voice a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm excited. It's another one that's obviously, like, 19 hours. And I just started getting a bunch of my holds came in. So I'll just, like, listen to it when I eventually don't have Libby holds.
I think it would be good for October.
That too. That's a good point.
Yeah, there's some paranormal.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of books that incorporate real life people into fiction, I'm just gonna keep talking about Mackenzie today. Sound like I'm just obsessed with her. I'm like, Mackenzie wore a pink shirt, so I wore a pink shirt.
And I'm like, am I following her?
She's Miss USA to NBA for anyone who's like, I really need to follow this Mackenzie person. But she has pollinated my reading style for sure. And then she loves to send me DMs, like, in all caps, like, stop influencing me when I'm talking about books. So it goes both ways. But she recommended this when she came on at the beginning of the year. My Government Means to Kill Me by Rashid Newsom. Mm. And it's also, this author is the writer and producer of The Shy. I think you say Shy, right? Chicago, The Chi, Narcos, and Bel Air. So this dude has been writing some stuff for a while, but this one. Andy's from Indianapolis. That's what made me pick this up, because you and I saw it as a local author when you were in Indianapolis. So I listened to it. But born into a wealthy Black Indianapolis family, Earl Trey Singleton III leaves his overbearing parents and their expectations behind by running away to New York City with only a few dollars in his pocket. In the city, Trey meets up with a cast of characters that changes his life forever. He volunteers at a renegade home hospice for AIDS patients, and after being put to the test by gay rights activists, becomes a member of the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power. ACT UP is the acronym. Along the way, Trey attempts to navigate past traumas and searches for ways to maintain familial relationships, all while seeking the meaning of life amidst so much death. So this one is heavy in a lot of ways, as you can probably tell. Because it's obviously like very much talking about what it was like to be both Black and gay, in the 80s. Which like would just be so difficult. 'Cause even like within, I mean, it covers all of it. Even within like the Black community, it was like extra looked down on to not be a super masculine man. So there's all kinds of stuff that was going on for someone in that time period. But he also kind of writes it. He writes like the chapters are like lesson one. So it almost kind of, it's almost written like it's like essays of a memoir. It's kind of like, that's the structure it reminded me of. And he kind of like each chapter is a lesson he learned in his time in New York City. So yeah, it's so unique. And like the, I mean, it's not spoilery, like the Trumps are a large presence in New York City. Like that whole, the whole family is in the 80s. And so like all of a sudden, like there's like Fred Trump popping up and you're like, whoa. And unfair housing practices from him in the 80s. 40 years ago. So there are these real life people that pop up and you're just like, oh yeah, I guess I see how we got to where we are in 2025, which has also been a theme for me this year, is trying to figure out how we got to where we are, or just have a better understanding. I generally know how, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, like the details and the the small things that like had a bigger effect probably than people thought they would at the time. So, but it's not a memoir, right? It's fiction.
No, it's fiction. Right. It's just kind of like written like the characters looking back on his time there and what he learned.
I like that.
Yeah. And it's pretty short. I think it was like a 6.5 hour audiobook. Yeah, 270 pages.
Tell me it's shorter than 8 hours.
I know.
Yeah. Sometimes when I'm like 13.
Right. I know.
I know. Yeah, that's really fascinating sounding. Have you ever read, it's not Rebecca McKenna, it's Rebecca, she did, I think it's called The Great Believers. It's got a yellow cover. She also wrote, like, I Have Some Questions for You or something.
Oh, Rebecca Mackay? Oh, yeah.
Yes. That one I believe took place during, or at least part of it takes place during the AIDS epidemic, and I've
in Chicago. Heard
it's really a powerful story. Wow. As well.
Yeah, I didn't realize she wrote non-thrillers.
Yeah,
that's cool.
Yeah, I've heard it. I mean, I think that's anything 1980s Chicago is going to be heavy. Well, speaking of yellow covers, did it to myself. The one, probably one of the first non-thriller books I had read in a while was The Yellow Wife by Sadeka Johnson. And she, I mean, people were like posting this all over the place at that time. This one's also pretty short. It's under 300 pages. And I would say for like a historical fiction, I felt like the pacing was like really fast.
Nice.
Born on a plantation in Charles City, Virginia, Phoebe Dolores Brown has lived a sheltered life, shielded by her mother's position as the estate's medicine woman and cherished by her master's sister. She has shielded by her mother's position as the estate's medicine woman and cherished by the master's sister, she is set apart from the others on the plantation, belonging to neither world. She'd been promised freedom on her 18th birthday, but instead of the idyllic life she imagined with her true love, Essex Henry, Phoebe is forced to leave the only home she has ever known. She unexpectedly finds herself thrust into the bowels of slavery at the infamous Devil's Half Acre, a jail in Richmond, Virginia, where the enslaved are broken, tortured, and sold every day. There, Phoebe is exposed to not just her jailer's cruelty, but also to his contradictions. To survive, Phoebe will have to outwit them, even if it means making the ultimate sacrifice. So the contradiction is that, like, I think she was a little bit like fairer skin tone, and she was like
yellow. I wonder if that's right.
To one of the slave holders, and like they had kids, and so I think that was like, common that.
Oh yeah,
like these women were like all of a sudden in higher
class. High society. Yeah,
that's
fascinating. I hadn't read the full synopsis. That sounds intense.
It is a hard read at times, but it's it moves. And then the author's note, because I had read this like a couple years ago, the author traveled there like with her family and was like looking at all the sites and like learning about this woman. And she's like, wow, what the heck? Like, there's this enslaved woman that's all of a sudden married to this guy at this like awful place.
Wow. Yeah, I have three of her books on my TBR.
Yeah, I read this one, and then The House of Eve.
Yeah,
is interesting as well. I really love the one of the narrators for that one is Ariel Blake. She's really good. She actually read the one that you had told me about, These Vicious Games.
Oh, nice. Yeah, They're Vicious
Games.
That's
how I found her, and I was like, "Who are you? I like your voice."
Nice. Yeah, I have Fallen Grace is the other Sadaka Johnson one that I have.
Oh, that's the one coming out soon, I believe.
Oh, it's not out yet. Oh, no, it's published 2024.
Oh, really?
But it says 50 pages. Okay, so that's a short.
Oh, okay. There's one coming out soon, I think.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
Keeper of Lost Children.
Oh, that's a cool cover.
And I think it's like,
oh, it's sad.
World War II, but it's also, it's World War II, but like not the typical World War II. I think.
Yeah.
I'm entering a giveaway on Goodreads as we speak.
Same.
I just had like a drive by, like I think a couple times we've talked about like Happy Land recently by Dalene Perkins Valdez, and her other book, Take My Hand, is also a really good one because I thought that it was going to be about like abortion for some reason, and it was not.
Yeah.
It was about like forced sterilization.
Oh, yes.
And it took place, like, it had a little more, like, courtroom drama than I anticipated. But, like, sometimes when you don't know what a book is going to be about, it's, like, even more enlightening. So, her books in general, like, have both taught me something that I didn't really know much about. Wow.
I was just reading about forced sterilization in the Original Sins book that I read that was about, the miseducation of America, so specifically Black and Indigenous children. But it literally became so common. I'm looking at my notes here. It was called a Mississippi appendectomy. And so they would tell Black and Indigenous women that their appendix needed to be taken out, and they would entirely remove their reproductive organs. And they just, it was so commonplace that it became called Mississippi appendectomies. So, and the book pretty much said that they justified it because not allowing more of those children to be born would save them money, because the children would be so stupid that the government would have to take. They use a different word than stupid. But yeah, it's fucked up. It is really fucked up.
Yeah. Yeah. I've read a few books also about just like eugenics in general. Like there's been a few, there's one called The Foundling, I think, by Anne Leary.
Okay.
That, I don't know. The whole thing is like so fascinating. Like people want everyone to have like all these kids, but it's like, but only these kind, actually.
Right. Right.
Yeah. So lots to learn from fiction, folks. Lots to
learn from fiction. Well, the other one that came to mind for me, I loves this one. Was it this year or was it last year? No, it was this year in May. The Manor of Dreams by Christina Lee. I loved this one. I talked about it a lot at the time, but it's like a lot of books, but definitely like, did you hear about Kitty Carr meets gothic horror?
Uh-huh.
Which is impressive to do both of those. So Vivian Yin is dead. The first Chinese actress to win an Oscar, the trailblazing ingenue rose to fame in the 80s, only to disappear from the spotlight at the height of her career and live out the rest of her life as a recluse. Now her remaining family members are gathered for the reading of her will, and her daughters expect to inherit their childhood home. Home is missing there. Vivian's grand, sprawling Southern California garden estate. But due to a last-minute change to the will, the house is passed on to another family instead, one that has suddenly returned after decades of estrangement. In hopes of staking their claim, both families move into the mansion. Amidst the grief and paranoia of the family's unhappy reunion, Vivian's daughters race to piece together what happened in the last week of their mother's life, only to realize they are being haunted by something much more sinister and vengeful than their regrets. After so many years of silence, will the families finally confront the painful truth about the last fateful summer they spent in the house, or will they cling to their secrets until it's too late? Yeah, there's so much that happens in this one, but you get like three generations, because you're getting like, you get Vivian Yin like at the beginning of her career, who is dead at like the beginning of the book. So we see her career. But what kind of does it, what's not even really touched on in the synopsis, is that like some of the haunting is a little bit related to, but not entirely. I don't want to give everything away, but like how many Chinese Americans were essentially enslaved to build the railroads, and like the horrific conditions that they lived through. And so then also that, then we also, especially with Vivian, you're getting that narrative of like someone who sees Hollywood for like the opportunity that it is to get herself like out of a situation, essentially. But it really is insane the amount of non-white people our country enslaved to build some of like the most important parts of it. So this one touches on that too.
Yeah. Oh my God, I saw this post from an account just called like History.
Mm-hmm.
And it was this like beautiful nice black and white photo of like an indigenous man on a cliff. It almost looked like Yellowstone or Yosemite or something.
Mm-hmm.
And like just the comment section of like the way we would think that. To me, it's like, obviously we did a bad thing.
Yeah.
Just like,
yes,
taking everything. Uh-huh. And the comments being like, well, they could have won the fight or whatever. And I was like, I did not know. Like, am I so naive and stupid that people think this way? And like, I couldn't believe it.
That's like one of my things that's making me aware, I guess, of my whiteness is like, I didn't know how many truly terrible white people there still are out there. Who think things like that and post it on the internet.
I know. I'm like, wow, that's so bold of you.
Yeah. I don't understand that. at all. Because it's probably someone who could not win a fight if someone tried to come take their home.
Right. There's these cultures that didn't have those type of weapons, and now you're saying that they should have won.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
Like,
and they're up against like disease, that was theirs, like forever, all kinds of
and
stuff.
Then all of a sudden we just tromp in and are like, oh, but you didn't beat me.
Yeah. I know.
But, and then I think of like how many generations have taught their kids that.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like the person making that comment was taught that that was a good thing, mm-hmm. or that we should be proud of that.
Yeah.
We earned it. And I'm like,
it's this manifest destiny thing that like the founding fathers said, where it's like, we were meant to have this. And so then like, it takes on this like godly quality of like, it was meant for us.
Yes. Like the sun is shining today for me because we did this. Yeah.
Yeah. It's, I don't understand it. It's been interesting too. Cause like I'll hear, I've just been listening to more people, and sometimes like, I may cut this out because I don't know if I'm going to say it eloquently enough, but like, it'll like, even at the beginning of Hood Feminism, she was like, this is an uncomfortable book for white people to listen to. And I'm like, it's not even uncomfortable for me. Like, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, I'm just like, it makes me very angry on your behalf. There's like that part going on, but I'm like, I both see my privilege and also am like, I didn't do that. I'm just trying to understand why understand more of the privilege that I have and like what I didn't have to. But like, I'm not uncomfortable hearing that a white person did bad things. Like, I know they did.
I don't know why people get so defensive about that.
But clearly some people are even just uncomfortable. I'm like, it's not that uncomfortable to just listen to someone's perspective. But I guess
who are you defending? Why are you defending that?
Yeah.
Like, just not even.
Yeah.
It's okay to say you were wrong. Like, I think that's one of those really interesting. I'm hoping that it's becoming, well, judging on the divisiveness, it's not. But like, I hope, like, on a micro level, like, I see therapy, emotional intelligence, like being aware of like what you've done wrong and not feeling like you can't apologize. Like, I believe that there's this shift happening, but I'm not really sure.
I know.
Or maybe it's just like in the current moment of like in my relationship, I can take responsibility.
Yeah.
But it's once it's I'm like, what do you care about defending these people that are long dead?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I agree.